Namaste. The first six chapters of Essays on the Gita basically give us the context and the background, and they in a way summarize the chapter one of the Bhagavad Gita. With the seventh chapter, the creed of the Aryan fighter, we'll enter into the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, Sri Aurobindo spends a lot of time giving us this context and background, and for very good reasons. Because often we hear people misusing the Mahabharata analogy, and almost he is not wanting us to turn into sword brandishing activists to see everything as a Mahabharata war. Now, Mahabharata war was a very special situation in which India had to be saved, and the war was the last alternative. After many, many centuries, another similar occasion came during the Second World War. Not even the First World War, Second World War. So, these are rare instances. Sri Aurobindo is not advocating pick up a sword and fight in the name of God. Why it's important is because we see in certain religions the idea of war. War is a necessity of life at a certain stage of evolution. But it has turned into almost a way of life. So he wants us to exercise that caution, restraint, and that's why we have this wonderful chapter, Creed of the Aryan Fighter. Who were those who went for war, first of all? This is important because even recently I had those certain people thinking that the Russia-Ukraine war is like the Mahabharata war. No, it is a war, and war has its own sides, it has its own plus and minus, some side is more right and some side is more wrong. But you can't compare it to the analogy of the Mahabharata war or the Second World War. Nor is he asking us to, you know, push ourselves into war. Because during the time of Mahabharata, first of all, nobody could think of world peace, world unity. It was a very far cry. There were severe warring instincts inside man, which had yet to be exhausted. Because we have emerged from the animal and all these instincts were there. But Indian thought and system had found a way for these warring instincts. So what way it had found? It had turned it into an art. That's what we see in one of the conversations of the mother. Mother says people don't understand. And she speaks about violence. And she says, unfortunately here, if you talk anything about Gandhi or Tagore, they think, you know, you are saying something, it's blasphemy. But she says, no, it's not like that. There are so many more beautiful, noble beings in India. But the West has promoted Gandhi and Tagore for their own reasons. Now, they were, you know, a kind of pacifist and this idea of non-violence. So the mother says, instead of teaching outer non-violence, turn violence into an art. So if you look at the Kshatriya tribe, violence, instincts of violence were turned into an art. And there was a very strict code for a Kshatriya. If he didn't live up to the code, even the Kshatriya community will, you know, look down upon him. So just some of these codes which were there prevalent during the Kshatriya, that they were supposed to protect the other three communities. The Brahmins were seekers after knowledge. The Vaishyas were those who would generate wealth, and the Shudras, the artisans, those people who fill our life with beautiful things. So all these three layers, they could not fight for themselves. So Kshatriya's work was to protect these other three groups of the social order. Secondly, was when Kshatriya was called upon to fight, he had to fight. He could not turn down a challenge. And this was there even in ancient Greece. So we see that famous story where Achilles challenges Paris, and now Paris has to go, and nobody is a match to Achilles. But it's ignoble to refuse the challenge. And so Hector goes, his elder brother, and we know that Hector dies. Hector turned out to be later to be Dilip Kumar Roy in this life. So For a Kshatriya, it was much more noble to sacrifice his own life but safeguard the others, which is so different from what we observe in modern day warfare. Some people still follow it. I am aware of certain stories where people defended the honor of the country, honor of others, subordinates, and sacrificed their life. So the second duty of the Kshatriya was sacrifice. So he would do yagnas, even Ashwamedh yagna. Kshatriyas conducted the sacrifice and the Brahmins were the priests. So they would come and whatever they received would be shared by the rest, because these two people were the elite of the society. Unfortunately, that's how the division came, that elite group and those non-elite. But in the beginning it was that those who are more capable, they are the ones who do maximum for the society. But the less capable share the booty. So they gain from that. That was the whole idea. So a Kshatriya was never supposed to fight if somebody had lain down the arms, surrendered, or he was in a state that he cannot fight. So Kshatriya was not supposed to fight. Kshatriya was never supposed to raise arms against a woman or a child. So they were only people who had come for the battle. That's where the battle was taking place. He was not supposed to raid into another country, do pillage, loot, plunder. This was not how Kshatriyas were supposed to behave. So the only right, the Kshatriya had a right if he conquered a kingdom. Then he had to protect their people and he could use their wealth, marry the women who were left a widow. But other than that, he was not supposed to go on pillaging on the streets and doing, you don't find it. In Indian history, you don't find that kind of a beastly, asuric rampage. So this is where there were courts of the Kshatriya during that time. And that's the background. So when Shri Krishna begins to answer to Arjuna his state of dejection, he starts by reminding him of the honor of the Kshatriya. So he says, you are a Kshatriya and you have to fight this battle which you have not asked for. You have been thrust there. You stand today. It was not like you have raised the war. You have not raised the war cry. You're not the one who is guilty. You are the one who have been pushed to a corner where you have no other choice except defending yourself and the honor of the people who look up to you as the noble person. And if you let them down, it's not just about your taking sannyas. You can take sannyas. But you are letting down those, because it was the Kshatriya's duty to protect. So his laying down the arms meant that now Duryodhan and his like, they will invade. They will take possession of everybody. And then their way of life, which was, of course, by now we know what their way of life was. So their way of life, where a woman's honor and dignity is not protected, where the king is simply plundering, he is busy drinking and enjoying life. So that life they will impose. And you, by withdrawing from the battle, would become a cause for much greater damage to others than if you actually picked up the arms. Because this is the argument. If I pick up the arms, I'll be killing those, my own family members, for whose sake we win the battle and we share everything. So he says, you are not realizing that by laying down arms, you are going to cause a much greater damage. Because in any case, the Dhritarashtrians are not going to, they are not bothered about you. They'll be very happy. And then what happens? They will easily kill your brothers. They will plunder, loot, because they don't live by any honor. For them, war has become just another way to conquer and loot and plunder. So you will succumb to their plan. So this is the argument that Shri Krishna first gives him, that as a Kshatriya, it is your duty. You have been called upon to this war and therefore you fight. Now the second part, Vishwabindu takes great pains to explain that Arjun is speaking as if he is feeling a lot of compassion for those who are his near and dear ones. So Vishwabindu explains that compassion is not this. Compassion comes from a great height. And the sign of compassion is you would look upon the entire scene as brothers are fighting, and you will see from a very great that how ignorant humanity is, why humanity has to be led to the war. That is compassion. And then it will find a different solution. For instance, we have now this Kshatriya instincts, how the Divine Mother writes in that passage, a dream. which she wrote for the ashram. Auroville also has the same thing. So what does she say? The warring instincts of men will be turned towards conquering their own nature. So now they have upgraded the Kshatriyahood. So Kshatriyahood is now among those who belong to the new creation. It means that we should use that power of the Kshatriya to turn towards conquering our own lower instincts, our own nature. So she has already upgraded it. And so also with Brahmin is no more just one who could read the scriptures and be a pandit. He has to discover true knowledge, self-knowledge and world knowledge by going within. Similarly, a Vaishya. Vaishya is not just who is amassing wealth for himself and a few others, but Vaishya who is producing things and sharing it, the plenty with everyone. And so also Shudra becomes a servant and slave of God and nobody else. So all these four will come in one human being. That's what the new creation will be. But Arjun belongs to the old creation. There was no thought of a new creation that time. So Sri Krishna rebukes him, says, you are talking of compassion, but you don't know compassion. You are moved more by pity. Pity is a different thing. Pity is, oh, my relatives will die. I can't do this. I am feeling pain. Why? Because people you are attached to and therefore they should not. But those who are compassionate don't act under attachment. They act under wisdom. Compassion goes with wisdom. So he explains to him that what you are trying to do, Arjun, is mithyachar. Mithyachar is where you are projecting yourself as someone which you are not inside. He says basically, Arjun, you are attached to your family, which is okay in normal circumstances, but right now, your family members are standing in the way of truth. And therefore, you are duty bound to remove them because that is the honor of the Kshatriya. So by trying to put on the show of compassion, kindness, forgiveness, basically you are hiding your deep attachment and personal motives and selfishness. So Sri Krishna lays threadbare, and in a way it also shows how the divine works within all of us. We all know that when we try to put on a show of something which we are not inside, the divine will at one point open this up. And then it's a Pandora's box. All the things that we didn't want to show others and didn't want to see ourselves, we have to see it. So Sri Krishna opens threadbare all the strands of his nature and shows him, don't talk all these big things, compassion and kindness and forgiveness. Basically, you are acting under strong attachment. And that attachment of this kind doesn't behove a Kshatriya. His attachment is valid and all right when things are fine. But today, you are called upon for this great war. And if you engage in it, then basically, you will be doing your duty. And if you don't engage in it, then you will be incurring disgrace and dishonor for yourself and for everybody. So this is the background. So chapter 7, the creed of the Aryan fighter. First is the answer of the divine teacher to the first flood of Arjuna's passionate self-questioning. His shrinking from slaughter, his sense of sorrow and sin, his grieving for an empty and desolate life, his forecast of evil results of an evil deed is a strongly worded rebuke. In one rebuke, he opens up the entire, he does a surgical procedure in Arjuna. That look here, what are you and what is going on inside you? And then something very beautiful in the next passage, we are on page 57. The answer of a hero to a hero. Why? Because Sri Krishna, he is a Kshatriya. He himself has fought wars. So he knows what's going on inside. He knows the code of conduct. The answer of a hero to a hero, shall we say, but not that which we should expect from a divine teacher, from whom we demand rather that he shall encourage always gentleness and saintliness and self-abnegation and the recoil from worldly aims and cessation from the ways of the world. So this is what we today think saintliness, somebody who fights a battle. But India always had this idea that heroes, even it was there in the West also. We see in the Even in Christianity, it has been there, the order of the knights, people who would defend others, fight. But the mainstream did not accept it. That's how we see Joan of Arc was ultimately burnt at the stake. But she was fulfilling the order of the Kshatriya. She was a noble woman. And they couldn't understand. But in India, it has always been there. And of course, we know that how this great ideal has been distorted in a certain context. And that's why he takes pains to explain all this. The Gita expressly says that Arjuna has thus lapsed into unheroic weakness. His eyes full and distressed with tears, his heart overcome by depression and discouragement because he is invaded by pity. Is this not then a divine weakness? Kripa Vishtam. So basically it's like he feels. So the question that mankind can ask, human beings can ask, but what's wrong with it? He is not thinking about himself. He is thinking about others. He's thinking about his family members. So what's wrong with this? And it is that which, Aurobindo, is not pity a divine emotion which should not thus be discouraged with harsh rebuke? Or are we in face of a mere gospel of war and heroic action, a Nietzschean creed of power and high-browed strength of Hebraic or old Teutonic hardness? So this is all important because otherwise sometimes we extrapolate. Every battle is Gita. Every battle is now a battle between right and wrong. You take one side. It's not like that. In most of the battles, right and wrong are terribly mixed. Both sides are on the wrong and both sides probably are on the right. So turning everything into a battle of right and wrong is a human extrapolation. But the teaching of the Gita springs from an Indian creed, and to the Indian mind, compassion has always figured as one of the largest elements of the divine nature. He says that, well, Indian mind understood. So people may think that Sri Krishna is downplaying the quality of compassion, kindness. And Sri Aurobindo says, no, he is not downplaying. He knows very much that compassion is a divine quality. Still he is rebuking Arjuna. So why he is doing it? He explains. Now, Sri Krishna's first statement. Whence has come to thee this dejection, this stain and darkness of the soul? In the hour of difficulty and peril, asks Krishna of Arjuna. The question points to the real nature of Arjuna's deviation from his heroic qualities. There is a divine compassion which descends to us from on high. And for the man whose nature does not possess it, is not cast in its mold, to pretend to be the superior man, the master man, or the superman is a folly and an insolence. For he alone is the superman who most manifests the highest nature of the Godhead in humanity. So Buddha is also a Kshatriya. But when Buddha abandons the kingdom and goes, that is not unheroic. Buddha is a hero of another kind. He is going in seeking for a remedy for mankind. Like a hero, he tramples over desires. Like a hero, he tramples over weakness. Like a hero, he tramples over ego. He has turned the Kshatriya bhav into another dimension altogether. But that's not what Arjuna is feeling. So he says very beautifully, this compassion observes with an eye of love and wisdom and calm strength the battle and the struggle, the strength and weakness of man, his virtues and sins, his joy and suffering, his knowledge and his ignorance, his wisdom and his folly, his aspiration and his failure, and it enters into it all to help and to heal. We see during the how Sri Aurobindo stepped out of the Indian freedom struggle. He didn't tell his disciples, oh, Dandi March is going on, please go and join Gandhiji. Oh, people are waging a war against the British, please go and join. He was not doing that. That was watching the whole struggle. He knows what is going to emerge. Now the destiny of mankind is no more at stake because India's freedom has been secured. But during the Second World War, you see how he plunged and asked people to enter into it. In the saint and philanthropist, it may cast itself into the mold of a plenitude of love or charity. In the thinker and hero, it assumes the largeness and the force of a helpful wisdom and strength. Now he says that another aspect of compassion, which we forget. It is this compassion in the Aryan fighter, the soul of his chivalry, which will not break the bruised reed, but help and protects the weak and the oppressed and the wounded and the fallen. So compassion can be very, very heroic. It can even wage a war. Compassion for whose sake? The people who look up to you to defend you. And it's obligatory on you to defend them even if you have to lay down your own life in the battle. That's why in one of the aphorisms, Shivinda says, personal battles are best avoided. But when you have a larger cause, then you should fight. So that's the difference. We end up fighting personal battles. Oh, that person did this to me, therefore I must fight. Now that is not Kshatriya-like. There it's better to be forgiving, to be kind. But imagine somebody is overrunning an entire section of humanity and you say, I am forgiving Hitler because, you know, he is not even touched you. He is rampaging on human beings, trampling over them, their rights and everything. And at this point of time you say, I am forgiving you, it will sound very crude and vulgar. It is compassion to stop him. Even to kill him by whatever means. So that's where compassion has to be understood, he explains to us. But it is also a divine compassion that smites down the strong tyrant and the confident oppressor, not in wrath and with hatred. For these are not the high divine qualities. The wrath of God against the sinner, God's hatred of the wicked, are the fables of half-enlightened creeds. As much a fable as the eternal torture of the hells they have invented. But as the old Indian spirituality clearly saw, with as much love and compassion for the strong titan erring by his strength and slain for his sins, as for the sufferer and the oppressed who have to be saved from his violence and injustice. Therefore, when Krishna kills Kansa, or Rama kills Ravan, there is a divine compassion still at play. Rama liberates Ravan from his own wickedness, his own evil deeds, which have mounted to any extent. And Krishna slays Kansa and thereby liberates his soul. It's called in Indian thought, the term used is Uddhar. Uddhar means you release the person. You are liberating the person. It's not a senseless killing or a personal grudge that you grouse you have to equal. There is no avengeful, no vengeance in it, no vindictiveness in it, but something which you have to do for the good of the people. And therefore, next passage we see under inverted commas, a few lines below, I see not what shall thrust from me the sorrow that dries up the senses, and of all things self-pity is among the most ignoble and un-Aryan of moods. Its pity for others is also a form of self-indulgence. Why? Because you are shrinking. What happens when people feel in pity? Oh, this is so terrible and they just want to move. They can't do anything much. Or sometimes even when they do, it's because their own nerves are shaken up. So that's not what a Kshatriya is called upon. He has to be strong and calm in every situation. It is the physical shrinking of the nerves from the act of slaughter, the egoistic emotional shrinking of the heart from the destruction of the Dhritarashtrian because they are one's own people. In medicine, one practices this unwittingly. For instance, a surgeon cannot cut and operate if he is filled with pity. So you can't cut, let's say, ampute the leg if it is gangrenous. Or take away cancerous tissue if you feel pity. But it's only compassion that this little pain will perhaps save the person's life. So this is the spirit we have to understand the Gita. It's not the spirit of, okay, you told me and you said this to me and I am going to fight against you because I am right. And righteous battle I must fight because that's what the Kshatriya is meant to do. No, that's a misreading of the truth of the Gita. So this is not the way of the developed Aryan man. Okay. So next page, page 60, we'll see toward the end, the chapter begins. The answer of the teacher proceeds upon two different lines. First, a brief reply founded upon the highest ideas of the general Aryan culture in which Arjun has been educated. We can say almost that this part of the teaching, in fact, the only thing if at all in the Gita, is largely temporal. It is meant for the times. Because now we don't have those clear-cut Kshatriyas and Brahmins, because that has been destroyed for good reasons. But during a phase of time, when he says that it's better for a Kshatriya to die rather than shrink from battle, because if he fights a righteous battle, if he wins, he enjoys the kingdom. That's how he says. And he has a right to enjoy the kingdom. And if he falls, he perishes, then he goes to heaven. Now this is something which applies to a, if not just temporal, it applies to a certain section of humanity. For instance, people, those who are in the military. So they are the ones who, when they lay down their lives, the gates of heavens open for them. That's how Shri Krishna starts. And what does he say? So there are two lines. One is that those, that knowledge which was already prevalent at that point of time. And the second will develop into a 18 chapter argument, where he will touch upon the principle of action. But first thing is Arjuna's two concerns. One is that he will commit sin. And the second is, why the sin? Because he is killing. So killing is an act of sinfulness. So first thing that Shri Krishna does, and that's why the Gita is read in every Indian household at the time of death. Frankly speaking, the first two chapters, so only the second chapter is enough to take away entirely the fear of death. Very logically, Shri Krishna tells us, well, you may believe in soul or you may not believe in soul. If you don't believe in soul, then well, bodies have a beginning and bodies have an end. So what is there to grieve for something which anyways is going to happen? Now, he is not touching upon why you should kill. But first he says death is not a subject of grief, because if you don't believe in soul, still everybody dies. Those with bodies which are born, they die. So no new thing is going to happen. Some people die, they will die anyways today or tomorrow. And if bodies have a soul, then nobody really dies. Bodies have a beginning and an end, but the soul is immortal. This is the argument. The second part of the argument is, well, that's okay. But why I should be involved in this slaughter? So that's where Shri Krishna argues that, well, he tells him, you have not asked for this war. This war has been thrust upon you. And when a war is thrust upon you, then to run away and shrink from it is an Aryan. So this is the basic logic of this whole thing, because very often the two are mixed together and people use this sentence that nobody dies, nobody kills, nobody, whatever. So nobody is responsible for anything, therefore I can do whatever I feel like, since anyways nobody kills and nobody dies. So I can just kill someone and escape. No, the Gita is not saying that. And to do that is precisely what is known as devil quoting the scripture. So what is Shri Krishna saying? He's saying, page 61, the enlightened man does not mourn, somewhere in the middle, the enlightened man does not mourn either for the living or the dead. For he knows that suffering and death are merely incidents in the history of the soul. So that it's a sign of Aryan that he doesn't sit and start crying. He wakes up. Even when there is a person who is living and has a suffering. So what do? You mourn it, or you take the challenge and you take the next step. It's a moment of crisis. Take hold, take charge of the situation. Try to master it, control it, understand it. Give solace to those who need it. Do your deeds for them. So this is the Kshatriyahood, that the enlightened man does not mourn either for the living or the dead, because he knows these things come in everybody's life. The soul, not the body, is the reality. All these kings of men for whose approaching death he mourns have lived before. They will live again in the human body. For as the soul passes physically through childhood and youth and age, so it passes on to the changing of the body. The calm and wise mind, the dhira, the thinker, who looks upon life steadily and does not allow himself to be disturbed and blinded by his sensations and emotions, is not deceived by material appearances. This there is embedded in Indian teaching. It's a different thing that most people don't practice it. But actually it is so true. And very often when somebody has departed, any which way. So when you are mourning, for whom are you mourning? You're mourning for yourself. The other person is, in the Indian teaching, he is passing into the beyond. He is, after a short while, is looking forward to a new body. And he will enter a new and beautiful body. What is there to mourn? He is progressing, he is evolving. What is there to mourn? You are mourning because it's a personal loss to you. But that means you never understood that today or tomorrow, all this is going to go away. So if one lived in the fullness of the Aryan teaching, then one would not mourn. Okay, temporarily the senses are hit, the emotional being is covered for a moment. But very soon the dhira comes back, bounces back. Well, it is inevitable and you give a nice send-off because you know that if you mourn, it is going to trouble the person who is departing. So when you know that, then instead of mourning, you will send a nice goodbye. So this is how first argument that he gives to Arjun is that why are you acting so un-Aryan-like? Because you know that their rebirth is a reality, the soul passes on and comes back in new bodies. He looks beyond the apparent facts of the life of the body and senses to the real fact of his being, and rises beyond the emotional and physical desires of the ignorant nature to the true and only aim of the human existence. What is that real fact, that highest aim? This, that human life and death repeated through the aeons in the great cycles of the world are only a long progress by which the human being prepares and makes himself fit for immortality. So this is something always to remember, that why we are here. And to understand, we are all passing in this great, tremendous journey. We meet together for some time. There are very nice sayings which remind, act like reminder. One of them in Hindi, I'll translate in English. But the original Hindi is, "Itne din ka dana pani saath tha. These many days of togetherness were given to us." That's it. So once you know that knowledge is there in the background, at least as a kind of a deep, profound wisdom which has trickled into us as the information transmitted through the generations, then we say it's okay. We enjoyed life together, wonderful. Let's keep pleasant memories, happy memories, and let the person carry on. Because that's a knowledge. You cannot have anybody forever with you except the divine. So once we have this knowledge deep within, ingrained into our very stuff of being, then it acts like a buffer. And we have so many stories in the Bhagavad, for instance. We have the story where the king calls his child because he's suffering, because the child has passed away. And the child comes and says, "But who are you? You are no more my parents." There's a story of the mother where she says that a 4-year-old girl had passed away. And when the parents came to meet, she says, "I don't know what to tell them, because that girl, that soul is here. She is very happy." And when the parents came, she had the thali, and this child is pointing out to mother, "Give them this flower, give them this flower." And she would pick up those flowers and give them, not realizing that this child, their child, who is now in the state of soulhood, is happy to be with her and just gifting them as a parting gift. But the parents are mourning. And she says, "I don't know what to tell them." Because obviously she can't tell them that. That's it may sound very insensitive. But that is the truth. We have the story of Chamdi was once narrating that when her father had passed away, she was just very small, and her mother went to meet the Divine Mother, Minidhi. And as she goes and meets her, the mother is waiting at the door for her, and she could sense her, like a drop of tear in her eyes, because she understood human feelings. And then the mother asked her, "Do you want to see him? He is with me, happy." Then she is surprised. She had not expected this. So she says, "No, mother. If he is with you and happy, why should I see and try to?" So these are the real facts which is other side of the story, which in India is embedded in the culture because plenty of mystics have spoken of the same thing. And we must remember it because we have forgotten it. So this is the real fact that we are all on our journey towards immortality, and we meet together, we part, but we meet again, we part again. It's all right. It's like some people go abroad to study, leaving behind their family. So it's something very similar to that. In Baji Prabhu also we have something very similar. When Tanaji says, "I know, Baji, you are going to die. I'll build a nice fire for you." He says, "Who is going to die? You think I am this 5'2" tall fellow? I will not die, nor can you ever build a pyre for me. But I'll wait for you, Tanaji. I am going there. But I know that you will also come this way, sacrificing your life, because you are a warrior. And when you come, we will greet each other and take cognizance of what has happened." So this was the code of the Kshatriya Varya, the Aryan culture. So mourning, grieving, this is un-Aryan. It's not regarded. It's natural at some point, because there are people, not all are strong like the Aryan and the Brahminatva, that is not strong enough in them. They are more emotional. So it's okay. It's not like you have to forcibly stop your tears. No. But you have to understand there is a higher way. Same we see Cleopatra when she is going to, when she is from every side, Caesar has died and people are closing upon her, and she has an 8-year-old son, and he is totally confused. What's happening? And she has somehow taken him away and has to send him away now. Why? Because she has decided to die with that snake bite. She has got carrying the snake with her. And then she tells the son, because he is confused, perplexed, and he is still a prince. She says, "Noble children, children of royalty, they don't cry." That was ingrained. You're not supposed to cry. And then he sends bye-bye, nice face, he remembers. And then she kills her. This was the highest form. Not everybody could live it. But Arjun is not everybody. Arjun is among the Shrestha. That's what we have to understand. Shri Krishna is not telling this to anyone and everyone, but to those who are noble and great. And how shall he prepare himself? Who is the man that is fit? Fit for what? For immortality. The man who rises above the conception of himself as a life and a body, who does not accept the material and sensational touches of the world at their own value, or at the value which the physical man attaches to them. So there is the man who attaches too much value to life in the body, and he has his right to do so. This knowledge is not meant to be forcibly thrust down people's throat. If somebody is crying, "Are, why are you worried? Nobody dies, nobody sees the Gita." That's not how it is. I remember a friend, he told this to his grandfather. "Are, you have been reading the Gita, don't you know that there is all this is all nobody really, there is nothing to worry about death." And he died. And then that night my friend had a dream. His grandfather came to him. And this man, my friend, started experiencing deep pain in the chest. And he was frightened beyond his... And then his grandfather tells him, "Now you understand what is the pain of death." So he got up with a fear. And then he randomly takes out one of Sri Aurobindo's writings just to get solace. And he opens the Prashna Upanishad, has his sloka. And suddenly his eyes fall on that sloka, that we are attached to the body with 101 subtle nerves. And it is these that constitute the pain of death in the parting, because you have to detach yourself. Now if you detach yourself while living, you have no pain in the passing. And the mother says that. If you have practiced inner detachment, then there is no pain. Because inwardly you are free. But if you are clinging to life, then what will that fellow do, whoever comes? He will forcibly, because your time has come. The more he pulls you, and the more there are people who are pulling you on this side, you will be miserable. That's why we see even in Savitri, death tells Savitri, "Woman, release your husband, release your man. Your husband suffers. Don't cling." Because... So she allows death to take away. Then she goes and brings back, because that is the law that needs to change. So this is how he says, this is the real truth by which we have to live. Very powerful lines, page 62, paragraph starts with that. There is no such thing as death, for it is the body that dies and the body is not the man. Finite bodies have an end, but that which possesses and uses the bodies is infinite, illimitable, eternal, indestructible. So once the mother had a New Age association, we know that Kishore Gandhi used to hold it, and she would give a question and all the students will reply. So the question that year was, what is death? The final comment was given by the mother. So everybody wrote things and mother corrected. It's available in, I think, volume 12, New Age Association under that. So she would correct everybody's answer. She would slightly add, correct. At the end, she has to give her comments. So her comment is, in fact, there is no death. So because that is the highest thing. There is no death. There is a constant change. Human body, if you say changing the body, then the body changes itself 7 times at least during one lifetime. We don't use the word death because there is a continuity through the memory. But even when memory is lost, as in dementia, we don't use the word death because the body is the same. But there is similarly something within us that never dies. So this is how we have to conceive. There is no death. Death is only of finite things because they are limited. Therefore, they have to... limited things have a dated. There is nothing which is permanent, forever. So forever and never is a language of ignorance. Forever applies only to the divine. So this is the thing which he reveals. Okay. And then on page 65, we'll skip there. Then after revealing about death, its non-reality, and there is no cause for grieving for death either which way, then now he talks about the Kshatriya aspect. That okay, whether death is real or not, that's a different story. Right now you are on the battlefield and you are a Kshatriya. And you can't run away from this battle. So page 65, there is no greater good for the Kshatriya than righteous battle. Maybe for a Buddha it is all right, or for a Brahmin it is all right not to engage in the battle, but to contemplate the causes of the battle and come up with a thesis and a manual, how can you avoid war? Brahmin can do it, but Kshatriya can't start doing that. So the greater good for the Kshatriya than righteous battle, and when such a battle comes to them of itself, this is the important part. Kshatriya is not somebody like the jihadist mentality that you go and bomb somebody and you will go to heaven. No, you will go to hell. Nobody has, you can't just open fire randomly. You have to challenge. That's why even in Indian military, even a terrorist, you just don't shoot randomly. Even in police, one of the reasons why they sometimes have a problem is you have to first challenge. And if in challenge the person either retaliates or does not listen despite repeated challenges, then you can shoot. So there are certain codes you have to follow. So it's not about just blowing yourself up and killing people to convey a point and therefore you will go to heaven. No, certainly not. But the Kshatriya had a way. And what was the Kshatriya's way? When a battle is thrust upon you, that's what he is telling. This is an important distinction. And when such a battle comes to them of itself, like the open gates of heaven, happy are the Kshatriya then. If thou doest not this battle for the right, then hast thou abandoned thy duty and virtue and thy glory, and sin shall be thy portion. That he was talking about sin. He said, by not fighting this battle that has been thrust upon you, and people look up to you. If you fall, they fall. Mercilessly they would be butchered. See what a difference from the standpoint taken by Gandhi against Hitler. He says, we will not fight. Let him come and occupy. But yes, inwardly we will not. So this was his stance. He says, this is so stupid and foolish. This is being thrust upon you. And when a battle is thrust upon you, you must fight. That's why Shobindu put all his force with the Allies, that they have to fight now because this battle has been thrust against them by the Nazis. So that's how he says that there is no greater good. For what is, few lines, couple of lines below, for what is worst grief for a Kshatriya? He says you are thinking about grieving for family. What is grief for a Kshatriya? It is the loss of his honor, his fame, his noble station among the mighty men, the men of courage and power. That to him is much worse than death. Battle, courage, power, rule, the honor of the brave, the heaven of those who fall nobly. This is the warrior's ideal. And the last line on this page, slain thou shalt win heaven, victorious thou shalt enjoy the earth. Therefore arise, O son of Kunti, resolved upon battle. So this is how we have to understand that background of the teaching. Shri Krishna is asking Arjun to fight, and why he is asking him to fight. It doesn't mean that he is sanctioning all fight and all kinds of personal battles and, you know, say no, we have to be like Arjun and fight the battle. Now, this is important, that for a Kshatriya, loss of his fame and honor were considered worse than death. So we have instances in the Mahabharata and even in Ramayana where he says that, well, this, if you demean somebody, if you lead to a loss of honor of someone, then it is as good as punishing by death. Because there is a whole episode in which Yudhishthir or Arjun transgresses something and he is supposed to kill him. And instead of killing, he says, well, loss of honor is regarded as good as death for a Kshatriya warrior. Similarly, we see that Lakshman at the end of the Ramayana, where Lakshman disobeys his brother because of the exigency of the situation. Durvasa Rishi is very angry, and when he goes, Rama is supposed to give him death sentence. That's the arrangement. But Ram doesn't do that. Ram says, you go away from the kingdom. So there, that's considered as good or worse than death, because death for a Kshatriya is a matter of glory. He embraces it. But being abandoned, being outcast, dishonor is considered a greatest of worse than death. It's because you are living, but you are living with dishonor. So all that he says. And then page 66. Whichever you consider, the result is the same. But if you are not satisfied with your social duty and the virtue of your order, if you think that leads you to sorrow and sin, then I bid you rise to a higher and not sink to a lower ideal. Now start something. Shri Krishna is opening the door to a whole teaching. He says, okay, but you may not be convinced with my arguments that there is no death and Kshatriya honor and Kshatriya duty. So what is that higher truth? Put away all egoism from you. Disregard joy and sorrow. Disregard gain and loss and all worldly results. Look only at the cause you must serve and the work that you must achieve by divine command. So thou shalt not incur sin. So he says, forget everything else. This is the time when you have to listen to the divine command. And the divine command is slay. And what is the divine command? He puts in very powerful words this last passage, which is one of my favorite ones from the Gita. So I love this passage. So it's about you're caught in different dilemmas and conflicts. So what is that greater truth? And Sri Aurobindo immortalizes it in one of his aphorisms, that he who would not slay when the divine commands him to do so, does in the world an incalculable havoc. But then he says, but be sure that it is the divine who has commanded you to slay. He says that. You can't just, you know, say divine has commanded me. Now they're right and wrong, everything goes away. Mother was asked about Rama's killing of Vali and all that. He says, when divine acts, he acts under his own light. You cannot question that because it's under a different impulsion altogether. And Sri Aurobindo also puts it very beautifully. Krishna killed Kansa and Rama killed Vali. While we may argue it is right or wrong, but this we know, that they acted divinely. They acted divinely. Now, when you act under a divine impulsion, it's a different story altogether. So he's telling him that, well, if you don't want to understand this argument, fair enough, but you understand that there is something called as divine impulsion. Again, word of caution, because divine impulsion, anybody can say, I got the divine impulsion to give you a blow. So who gets the divine impulsion? He's clarifying. That's my favorite passage. It is the creed of the Aryan fighter, no God. You can't talk about divine impulsion unless you have known the divine. Then you have known the divine, divine impulsion. No God, it says. Know thyself. You must be living in your soul. Don't live in the vital and say that I have got the divine command. Help man. It should not be anything which is meant for your personal satisfaction. Protect the right. You're not fighting just because you were right. You're fighting because there are that which is right, a greater ideal, a higher good. Do without fear or weakness or faltering thy work of battle in the world. It is the creed of the Aryan fighter. Know God. It says, know thyself. Help man. Protect the right. Do without fear or weakness or faltering thy work of battle in the world. Thou art the eternal and imperishable spirit. Thy soul is here on its upward path to immortality. Life and death are nothing. Sorrow and wounds and suffering are nothing. For these things have to be conquered and overcome. When they come in life, Kshatriya says, okay, I'll drink it as a strengthening wine, bitter though it may be. He rejoices even in that because he is Kshatriya. He doesn't admit defeat in the face of suffering. He conquers suffering. He masters himself. So he says these things have to be conquered. Then what you have to only focus upon? Look not at thy own pleasure and gain and profit, but above and around. Above at the shining summits to which thou climbest. Around at this world of battle and trial, in which good and evil, progress and retrogression are locked in stern conflict. He says, you're thinking about you and your friends and your family members? How silly. How small you can be. You're looking at your selfish interest. If I say something about against this man, he may harm me or he may give me favor. How small you can become. He says, that's not what you are meant to see. Look above. That's your goal. Your goal is not these people, to please them, to flatter them, or to be afraid of them. Your goal is immortality, the summits. And look around where good and evil is locked in a conflict. You have to take a stand sometimes and choose. Now he's beginning to give us a principle of action. And here he gives us the principle. Men call to thee. Why? Because he's capable. If Arjun is not capable, it's okay. If he would have just left the battle. Shri Krishna doesn't tell Vidur, why are you being suddenly neutral now? You know that Pandavas are right. You better fight. He doesn't tell. He even doesn't tell Balram, paradoxically. But Balram has to make his own choice. But he doesn't tell everybody that you must come and fight. But to Arjun, he tries to prevent Karna. Because he says, if you fight, you are on the wrong side of history. And because he loves Karna at some point, he says, look, don't fight for Adharma. Because by doing this, you are going to incur much worse. And that's why Shri Krishna's bidding to Arjuna to slay Karna was a special grace to Karna, because he would have been totally in a state of dishonor. Ultimately, Duryodhan had to be slain. Nobody could have defended him. And if he kept on prolonging it, he didn't die. He would have had to live with the same dishonor that Ashwatthama lived with. And he may have committed much worse sin. So Shri Krishna says, I'll give you a nice death at the hands of Arjun. Through a Divyastra. People may call Arjun that, why did you shoot? And they may tell me, but I am being compassionate towards you. You have to go, but better go in a nice, decent way. So that's how one has to understand the play of the divine. Men call to thee, their strong man, their hero for help. Help then, fight. Destroy when by destruction the world must advance. But hate not that which thou destroyest. This is the inner surgery that a Kshatriya is called upon to do. neither grieve for all those who perish. In the passage of time, they have gone. Tomorrow they will come again and you will embrace them as friends. That's how the Mahabharata ends. All of their souls come out and these Pandavas, they greet each other and say, very nice. They have a kind of party. In heaven also they have a party. But here you are called upon to fight. Because that's in the world march, this is the situation. Know everywhere the oneself. Know all to be immortal souls and the body to be but dust. How powerful and liberating. Do thy work with a calm, strong and equal spirit. Fight and fall nobly or conquer mightily. For this is the work that God and thy nature have given to thee to accomplish. These are the code of honor. In most professional armies they are followed. I know about India and I'm sure in other professional armies that you don't shrink or run away from a battle which has been thrust upon you. And if you have to fight, you may fall. You have fallen nobly. It's a matter of pride. And if you conquer, all right, that's also wonderful. But you're not conquering for yourself. You're conquering for the nation. So this is the spirit that with which this chapter ends. I'll just read it quickly and then we'll stop. Know God, know thyself, help man, protect the right, do without fear or weakness or faltering thy work of battle in the world. Thou art the eternal and imperishable spirit. Thy soul is here on its upward path to immortality. Life and death are nothing. Sorrow and wounds and suffering are nothing. For these things have to be conquered and overcome. Look not at thy own pleasure and gain and profit, but above and around. Above at the shining summits to which thou climbest. Around at this world of battle and trial in which good and evil, progress and retrogression are locked in stern conflict. Men call to thee, their strong man, their hero for help. Help then, fight, destroy when by destruction the world must advance. But hate not that which thou destroyest. Neither grieve for all those who perish. Know everywhere the one self. Know all to be immortal souls and the body to be but dust. Do thy work with a calm, strong and equal spirit. Fight and fall nobly or conquer mightily. For this is the work that God and thy nature have given to thee to accomplish. Okay.